LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hi, folks. This is Will Acheson. I'd like to welcome you to our first Thursday podcast of 2014. I'm with the Labor Relations Information System, and in our podcast, we review the things that have occurred over the last 30 days that may have some significant impact on public safety labor relations. And this month, we have a jam-packed agenda. There's a lot of information that I want to cover. I want to start by talking about what the latest economic figures show us, what the rate of inflation is projected to be for 2014, and generally how things are looking from an economic standpoint. I also want to cover the Detroit bankruptcy case and what that means in terms of whether or not there are constitutional protections for pensions in a bankruptcy process. We've got a couple of very fascinating promotional cases, one out of Cleveland that deals with whether or not you can have residency bonuses in promotion. I also want to cover, one of the most significant Bill of Rights cases to come out of a court in many years. This one comes out of the California Court of Appeals and deals with the issue of whether a not sustained allegation actually triggers a hearing under the Bill of Rights. And then we have our usual potpourri of the cases from around the country dealing with public safety labor relations. So let's get right to it. Let's get right to economic projections. With the new year, it's time to take a look at what 2014 might bring. In areas such as inflation, employment, interest rates, housing, and the like. All of this plays an important part in public sector finances, and thus plays an important part in public sector labor relations. Where do you go for information like this? We have a couple of sources that we rely on. Those aren't the only ones that we look at, but there are a couple that we think do a very good job of collecting economic forecasting information. The first is the Congressional Budget Office. The sole purpose of the Congressional Budget Office, or the most important purpose, is to provide non-politicized projections as to economic indicators so that Congress, when it adopts a budget, won't find that 2 or 3 years down the road there's either way too much money or more likely not enough money to pay for the programs that have been budgeted. A second source that we like is Kiplinger.com. That's Kiplinger.com. Kiplinger, which publishes a variety of different things, has a year-end edition where they collect economic forecasts and make economic forecasts in a variety of important areas. It's a pretty accessible webpage, and we recommend it to you. So let's start with inflation, probably the most important economic factor in collective bargaining these days. The projections are that inflation is going to be under 2% once again. It looks like the year-end inflation for 2013 is going to be in the range of about 1.4 to 1.5%. And the projections are that for 2014, inflation will be in the range of about 1.8%. The Federal Reserve has a target rate of 2 to 2.5%. That's a rate where the Federal Reserve will start considering tinkering with various of the interest rates that it sets. And nobody seems to anticipate that we are going to hit that 2 to 2.5% range. In other words, we're looking like we're going to have a lot of stability in the area of inflation and that it's going to be at about 1.8%. Somewhere in that range. And the inflation rate is driven by a number of other economic factors. One of them is gross domestic product, and here the news is good. In fact, pretty much all of the economic news I'm going to give you is good. It's nice to be able to do one of these where everything is positive. Economic growth is predicted to strengthen in 2014, and it looks like the rate of economic growth is going to actually exceed inflation. Always a good thing. Economic growth will be at about 2.5%. Some of you may be wondering, you heard stories about how the government shut down and that bizarre thing we did called the sequester, how that affected economic growth in 2013, and it turns out it did. It turns out that instead of a growth rate of about 2.8% in 2012, we had a growth rate of 1.8% in 2013, and that really, the decline in the growth rate can be pointed directly to the shutdown and the sequester. Hopefully, that doesn't happen, and hopefully we have this higher projected growth rate of 2.6% next year in 2014. As you might expect, employment numbers are predicted to rise. In November of 2013, we had a job gain of 203,000 nationally. That follows a job gain of 200,000 in October. The number of layoffs is on the decline, and the experts predict a continued growth in the job market. What about interest rates? Well, long-term interest rates are probably, the projections are, will end up the year at about 3.5%. That's lower than they are now. The rates available in 2013 were as low as 3%. As you know, if you've been trying to buy a house, they're likely to creep up to about 3.5%. If you were buying houses in the 1980s and 1990s, that 3% will still seem, or 3.5%, ridiculously low. So we're looking at moderate long-term interest rates. That, again, is good for economic growth. What about energy prices? Predictions are that energy prices will remain stable and, if anything, are likely to drop. And that's because of an increased supply of oil that is available and also an increased supply of natural gas. What about the housing market? So much of public sector finances is dependent upon the health of the housing market. Predictions are that the housing market is going to continue to expand. Probably not at the very fast rate that you saw in 2013. It increased at 9.3% in 2013, but probably the predictions are at the range of around 4%. Why the decline in the rate of growth of the housing market? Well, it's because of something I just mentioned. The long-term interest rates are predicted to go up, and as they go up, that means there's less people willing to buy houses, and thus the housing market won't grow at quite the same rate. Lastly, what about retail sales? Many local governments are dependent in large part on retail sales tax revenues, and retail sales are predicted to accelerate pretty quickly in the range of about 5.5% for 2013. That's an increase from the rate of growth in 2013 of 4.5%. So we're going to go to 5.5% in 2014. This is all a collection of pretty good news, once you think about it. Increased retail sales, increased housing starts, increased sales of existing houses, stable, if not lower, energy costs, greater employment, lower unemployment rates, a continued increase in the gross domestic product, and moderate inflation. All of that spells that it will be a good year for public sector agencies who are continuing in their efforts to recover from the recession of 2007. Let's move on, though, to some troubling news from an economic standpoint, and that is the situation in Detroit. I'd like to say at the outset, thanks to Mike Coviello, an attorney in Florida, who did a lot of work on this issue for us and prepared what will be the lead article in our newsletter, Public Safety Labor News, on the Detroit bankruptcy. You may have heard that there has been a federal court ruling dealing with the city of Detroit, its efforts to gain bankruptcy protection and pensions. And here's what's going on in the situation in Detroit. You have to go back a few years to when the Michigan legislature enacted what's known as Public Law 436. And what this law did was to grant, in particular, the city of Detroit, the ability to seek bankruptcy protection from its pension obligations. And the city has a variety of different pension systems, including pensions, of course, for police officers and firefighters. They are defined benefit pension systems. Detroit is in a world of hurt economically. It has a debt, meaning it owes this money and doesn't have assets sufficient to cover it, of $18 billion. $4 billion of that debt is attributable to pensions, retiree health care, and life insurance that is provided to retirees. It's not like the retirees are really on easy street in terms of retirement benefits. The average non-public safety pension in Detroit is $18,000 a year. The average firefighter police officer pension is $30,000 a year. Really, the problem with the pension system is that it's been not funded by the city. As the city has run into economic difficulties, it simply stopped making necessary payments into the pension fund. That wasn't helped by the fact that the pension fund made some high-risk investments that failed. And you put all that together and you have a drastically underfunded pension system, one of the worst funded pension systems in the country. Detroit, under a new emergency manager, seeks bankruptcy protection. For those of you who are unfamiliar with it, bankruptcy protection is a function of the federal courts. There's a federal bankruptcy court. There's even a federal bankruptcy provision in the United States Constitution that sets up the entire structure for bankruptcy. When Detroit sought bankruptcy protection, it listed as some of its debts the pensions, and that quickly led to a group of police and fire and other retirees intervening in the bankruptcy proceedings, seeking to get a ruling from the court that pensions, and these are pensions for existing retirees, were not subject to the bankruptcy process. And the ruling that you may have read about, it came out, I believe, in early December of 2013. The ruling was from a bankruptcy court rejecting the argument made by the retirees that their pensions were safe from the bankruptcy process. The retirees had essentially two arguments. They made a number of them, but there are two that I think are the most significant. The first is that the bankruptcy code, the very provisions of the United States Code under which this whole case is being handled, that they violated what's known as the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. What's the 10th Amendment? The 10th Amendment says that any powers that aren't explicitly granted to the federal government under the Constitution are reserved for the states. And so what the retirees were saying is, look, the bankruptcy code can't trump state and state laws, including state pension laws, and can trump state constitutional provisions that protect pensions. None of that is possible without the consent of a state legislature. And if you have an interpretation of the bankruptcy code that subjects pensions to bankruptcy protection, that's a 10th Amendment violation. That allows the bankruptcy code to prevail over contrary state law. The court rejects that challenge and says, look, bankruptcy codes only apply to a limited portion of a state's financial affairs. In this case, it's the limited portion is not even the entire state. It's just the city of Detroit. And thus, by enacting the bankruptcy code, the court says, Congress wasn't seeking to control the state's legislative authority on financial matters in general. And thus, the separation of powers provisions of the 10th Amendment don't apply. Now for the biggest argument. The retirees said, look, our pensions are contracts. And they are contracts where we put in our side of the contract. We did our work for 20 or 25 or 30 years and retired. And the other side of that contract is that the state and the city agreed that we would be paid a certain pension. And in fact, you know, part of the pension we funded through our own contributions. There's a clause, say the retirees, in the federal constitution. There's also one in the Michigan constitution. Parenthetically, there are these clauses in almost every constitution that prohibits what's known as the impairment of contracts. It's called the contracts clause, usually the contracts clause of the federal constitution or of a particular state constitution. What the retirees say in the Detroit case is that if you allow an employer to undo its pension system, you are allowing it through the bankruptcy code to impair the contract that it has with its retirees. I would say, by the way, that the contract clause is long thought to have been the primary protection for public sector pensions. And what the court ends up saying here is, I don't think, says the judge, there is a contracts clause problem. Why? Because there's no heightened protection for this particular type of contract under the law, says the court. The court says, look, bankruptcy is nothing more than a debtor, in this case the city of Detroit, being able to get out from underneath contractual obligations. The contractual obligation may be in the case of an individual who's going through bankruptcy, the obligation to make time payments on a car. In the case of a municipality, it may be a contractual obligation to repay bond purchasers who loaned the city money. Or it may be a contractual obligation to provide pensions. And what the federal constitution does by having this clause that allows bankruptcies to occur, the federal constitution, in essence, creates an exception to the contracts clause for bankruptcies. And in sum, what the court found was that bankruptcy provisions of federal law give states broad powers to impair contracts between private parties as well as governmental entities and private parties without regard to whether the services provided by the other party have already been rendered, without regard to whether or not pension rights have vested, and even without regard to whether the pension rights were guaranteed by a state constitutional provision. In other words, a contractual pension right, says the court, is no different than any other contractual right and is subject to modification in the bankruptcy process. Now, what's left on the table in the Detroit case, except for, of course, the appeals that will no doubt follow, what's left on the table is what happens to the pensions. As I mentioned, the pension debt in Detroit is actually a relatively small amount of the city's total unfunded liabilities. It's $4 billion of $18 billion. The next stage in the process is going to be to come up with a plan under which the city can emerge from bankruptcy. And that plan is going to be that the various creditors, including the bondholders and including retirees, will get so many cents on the dollar for their obligations. What we don't know is what that plan is going to look like. That's going to take a considerable amount of time to occur. This is the first major case that we have seen involving the question of whether a public employer can get out from under vested pension rights through the bankruptcy process. This is the case that if you are in a financially distressed environment, this is the case that you need to keep watching. Fair prediction, this case won't end with the decision of a single bankruptcy judge in Michigan. All right, let's move on to the continuing litigation over residency requirements and residency provisions in the city of Cleveland. There's a bit of a history here with respect to residency rules. Going as far back as 1931, where there were civil service requirements in Cleveland that city employees be residents of the city. There was a lot of litigation over residency requirements and how they applied to firefighters and police officers. There are a number of cases that you can read where an officer or a firefighter maintained residences both inside and outside the city, and the question was, how much time did they spend in the city? Where did they get their mail delivered? Where did their kids go to school, et cetera, et cetera? Well, all of that seemingly ended in 2006 when the Ohio legislature, it's called the General Assembly in Ohio, the legislature enacted a statute. It's known as RC 9.481. I won't refer to it again other than I'll call it the residency statute. That statute in 2006 prohibited all political subdivisions in the state from having residency requirements as a condition of employment. A variety of employers challenged that statute. The case went all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, which said the statute is constitutional. It's a matter of overriding state interest, and thus it falls within an exception to what's known as the home rule provisions of the Ohio Constitution. And that meant that Cleveland's residency requirements were struck down. Not for too long, though, because in 2012, Cleveland voters amended their city charter, and they amended it to say that if you were a resident of a city, of the city of Cleveland, for at least 1 year after applying for promotion, and you got a passing grade on the promotional examination, you'd get an additional 5 points added to your score. Well, that didn't sit well with the Association of Cleveland Firefighters. They filed a petition seeking a declaratory judgment against the city, and what they wanted was a decision from a court saying that the residency bonus violated the state statute that prohibited residency requirements. And this case ends up in the Ohio Court of Appeals, which in late December decides the case in favor of the Firefighters Association. What was the city's argument in this case? Why is the city saying that this residency requirement can stand? Well, the city said, look, these preference points, they're a reasonable ingredient in the calculation of a candidate's fitness and merit for a supervisory provisions. An assistant city manager, excuse me, a chief of staff for the mayor said that the city got benefits from people who were residents of the city being promoted because those supervisors are able to respond faster to emergencies. And here's an interesting quote from the mayor's chief of staff. He testified that to the extent that supervisors have prior understanding and knowledge of the issues that arise in city neighborhoods, they're able to give a more complete and more informed recommendation or make a more complete and more informed decision about what's going on in that neighborhood. Why did the Court of Appeals not buy it? The court said, look, The argument you're making between residency and the fitness of a promotional candidate, that argument is very tenuous. The court said, look, what do you mean faster response times benefit the city? Well, when you have this rule, this promotional rule, that only requires that you be a resident of the city for a year prior to taking the promotional examination. You could move the day after you're promoted, and you would still be the beneficiary of those 5 points because you would have used them to get promoted. Therefore, response times cannot, by definition, be a reason to have this residency bonus. The court goes on at some lengths on this issue and says, look, an employee who resides in the city for 20 years but moves just prior to the one-year period set forth in this charter provision wouldn't get any credit for their residency experience. But presumably, because they lived in the city for 20 years, they'd have all of this local knowledge that the city touts as being the reason for the residency bonus. The court winds up its opinion by saying, look, to the extent that a promotional candidate might have some additional de minimis benefit that they could bring to their position based on their knowledge of the community, that knowledge could be fairly ascertained by a competitive exam. We see no reason why a candidate's knowledge of the needs and expectations of the residents of the city couldn't be determined competitively. And thus the court strikes down the 5 bonus points that Cleveland wanted to give in the promotional process. I do have to say that there's something the court doesn't talk about with respect to the city's arguments here that you see in other cases, and that is the notion that a residency rule can be tied to response times. Now, that might make some sense, say the courts, in a small town that is geographically isolated. But consider Cleveland, a city that does not have regular borders. In other words, there are parts of the city of Cleveland that are further away from the downtown core of Cleveland than parts of Ohio that are not in the city of Cleveland because of those irregular borders. And along the same lines, there are firefighters in Cleveland who live outside the city of Cleveland, but just on the edge of the city of Cleveland, who could respond faster to their stations than they could if they lived in the city of Cleveland, but far away from wherever their stations were. Courts don't look very kindly at a response time argument as justifying a residency rule. But this Court of Appeals, never actually tore into that issue. I think I can pretty much anticipate what the result would have been. We've got another firefighter promotional case for you. An interesting one, very different issue. This one comes out of the city of Jacksonville, Florida. And this arises out of a Federal Department of Justice lawsuit. DOJ sued the city in 2012, alleging that the processes, the promotional processes used by the fire department discriminated against African Americans. And among the allegations were that the DOJ said that the testing processes used for promotion in 2004 and 2008 to promote suppression captains, that those were discriminatory. Well, this case is pending in November in 2013, or a little bit before that, when the city issues a notice that it is going to hold promotional examinations. It's going to have examinations on November 18th of 2013, for fire suppression positions, captain positions. The Department of Justice pretty quickly files a motion for a temporary restraining order. And what the Department of Justice wants the federal court to do is to set aside 5 positions, five fire suppression captain positions from this 2013 promotional process. Four candidates who were allegedly discriminated against in the 2004 and 2008 test administrations. Got that? So what the city is saying is, look, excuse me, what the Department of Justice is saying is, look, you illegally discriminated in 2004 and 2008 against minority candidates. We don't know exactly who the victims of the discrimination were. We don't know their names. We just know their race. And we want you to set aside five positions from your latest process, 2013, 5 years after the 2008 exam. We want you to set aside five positions for whoever those victims of discrimination might be, the top five ranking victims of discrimination. That case goes to the, or that request for a temporary restraining order goes to the federal court in Florida, which in December of 2013 says, nope, I'm not going to issue a temporary restraining order. And the court is pretty actually direct about the Department of Justice in telling the Department of Justice, don't come here with these sorts of requests. And let me quote a little bit from what the court says. The court says, first, the ill-defined remedy that the Department of Justice seeks through the temporary restraining order, preserving five slots for test takers in the 2004 and 2008 exams, doesn't sufficiently correlate with the alleged injury to those test takers, and certainly doesn't warrant the major disruption to the fire department's promotional processes, the effects of which would likely radiate throughout the department for years. The court says, look, I'd have to be convinced that such a remedy, this TRO, was truly the only recourse. And I don't think it is, because you know what? You're going to have a trial on whether or not the 2004 and 2008 exams were discriminatory. And I will have the ability, if I find discrimination, I'll have the ability to go back and remedy that discrimination. Maybe that might be retroactively promoting the victims of discrimination. I don't know. But I have the ability to remedy any harm done from the 04 and 08 examinations. There's no reason to issue this temporary restraining order with respect to the 2013 examination. Also says the court, you're way too early, Department of Justice. The court says this is a complex case. You've all got expert witnesses. The expert witnesses who haven't even been subject to deposition yet, they disagree on whether or not the tests were discriminatory at all. They disagree on whether or not the city will be able to show a business necessity for the tests, even if they were discriminatory. They disagree on whether, if there's a business necessity, there are alternate tests that are out there that could test for the business necessity but don't have the discriminatory impact. The court says, I have no idea whether the Department of Justice is going to win on this case. And to get a temporary restraining order, you have to show that you will probably succeed on the merits, and that the Department of Justice hasn't done at the early stages of this litigation. And so the litigation will be ongoing, probably for a number of years. The court refers to the fact that it has a trial scheduled in the case in 2016. And so just keep your eye on the case and we'll see what happens. Let's move now from promotions to Bill of Rights, and in particular the California Bill of Rights. It's known as the California Public Safety Officers Procedural Bill of Rights. There's a pretty big case that just came down out of the California Court of Appeals involving the Los Angeles Police Protective League and the City of Los Angeles. LAPPL is the union that represents sworn officers up to and including the rank of lieutenant in the Los Angeles Police Department. The city is subject to the statewide Bill of Rights, and there's a section in the Bill of Rights, it's section 3304 if you're counting, that provides that any public safety officer who's denied a promotion or who receives any sort of, and I'm quoting, punitive action is entitled to an administrative appeal. So what's a punitive action? A punitive action is, and I'm quoting again, any action that may lead to dismissal, demotion, suspension, reduction in salary, written reprimand, or transfer for the purposes of punishment. So, what's up in LAPD to cause this litigation? Well, LAPD has, if you are the recipient of an internal affairs complaint in LAPD, it can result in a variety of different dispositions. And some of these are fairly standard, and some of them are kind of LAPD specific. The dispositions can be unfounded, exonerated, sustained with no penalties, insufficient evidence to adjudicate, or withdrawn by the chief of police. If the investigation comes up with insufficient evidence to either prove or disprove the allegations, LAPD will categorize the allegations as not resolved. And that's what this case is about. Is a not resolved adjudication of an internal affairs complaint, is that punitive action that allows an officer the right to a hearing under the statewide Bill of Rights? And the Court of Appeals says yes. And I'm going to do a little bit more reading from this court's opinion than I normally will, because I think this is really an important case. If you think about it, you have to have or offer a hearing in all not resolved cases. That's a big deal. Here's what the court says. In our prior cases, the considerations were whether the allegedly punitive action could be considered in future personnel decisions and whether it could impact the officer negatively. Now, mind you, I'm going to interject something here. Remember the wording of the California Bill of Rights. Punitive action is any action that may lead to, and then the list, dismissal, demotion, suspension, etc. So that's why the court is focusing on whether or not the adjudication could lead to negative impacts for an officer. Back to the court's opinion. It's not necessary to show that an action will result or has resulted in adverse consequences, only that a possibility exists that it could. Here, the not resolved adjudications are labels without explanations that could have negative consequences or could be misinterpreted. What the league seeks to prevent is the possibility that a not resolved adjudication is viewed together with other not resolved adjudications, creating the inference that there must be some truth to the allegations. We therefore don't agree with the city that the use of the classification can only be evaluated on an individual basis. And this is Will interjecting again. What's the deal here? Well, you see a number of employers taking the position that if you have a series of unproven or not sustained, or in this case not resolved, allegations against an officer, if you have a series of them, particularly in a relatively close period of time, where there's smoke, there must be fire. And that officer could be subject either to increased discipline when something occurs again in the future, or perhaps that'll be taken into account in a performance evaluation or in the promotional process or in the transfer process. That's what the Court of Appeals says is the potential for some sort of negative action that triggers the Bill of Rights. And the court concludes its opinion by saying here that punitive action has been interpreted to mean any action that may lead to these punishments. In LAPD, not resolved adjudications are used to establish a pattern of conduct by the officers under scrutiny. Thus, not resolved adjudications may lead to consequences enumerated in the Bill of Rights. As such, they are punitive actions entitling police officers to an administrative appeal under the law. Interesting case. First one we've seen under any statewide Bill of Rights around the country that deals with whether or not a not resolved or not sustained allegation triggers a hearing under a Bill of Rights. It'll be interesting to watch how this case progresses in the future. Next up, our Brady case for the month. And it's a whopper. It's a pretty significant Brady case coming to us out of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. Thanks, by the way, to Mike McGinnis, an old friend and a lawyer for police officers in North Carolina for over 30 years. And Mike litigates these public safety disciplinary cases in North Carolina in an environment where there is no collective bargaining. There's no statewide or even local collective bargaining in North Carolina. Rather, if there are any job protection rights that exist in North Carolina, they're going to exist under either an ordinance or some sort of state statute. This is a case that involves a state trooper by the name of Thomas Wetherington. And troopers in North Carolina are covered by a statute that requires the state patrols, called the State Highway Patrol in North Carolina, to have just cause before it terminates a trooper or disciplines a trooper. And so this case is litigated under the question of whether or not the patrol had just cause to discipline Wetherington, in Wetherington's case, to terminate him. What happened here? What are the facts that ended up being presented to the North Carolina Court of Appeals? Wetherington was on a traffic stop. He was stopping a truck with a boat, and somewhere in the process, he lost his hat, his trooper's hat. After the stop, he talks to his sergeant, and he says to his sergeant, "My hat blew off." During the course of the stop, and as it blew off, or after it blew off, I looked back towards the roadway. He saw a burgundy 18-wheeler coming down the road. He heard a crunch, and he never saw his hat again. Over time, Wetherington's story changed. The first iteration of the change was that Wetherington said that he placed the hat on the light bar of his patrol vehicle while he was conducting the stop. And then later, Wetherington ends up saying he doesn't really know how it was that he lost his hat. The hat eventually turns up, by the way. It turns up non-squashed, and it is produced by one of the people who was involved in the traffic stop. But none of that... the fact that the hat turns up, doesn't stop the patrol from starting an internal affairs investigation. And the investigation concludes with a finding that Wetherington was dishonest and had to be fired. And Wetherington appeals his discharge to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. And there's a couple of issues in this case. And the first one, which I view as probably a little bit less significant from a legal standpoint, is the court ends up finding that termination isn't appropriate in this case. The court says, look, there are a variety of different punishments that are available in this case, and we accept the conclusion that was reached in some of the appeals below. We accept a conclusion that something less than termination would have been the appropriate sanction for an officer who really had a very serious emotional reaction to all of this. Wetherington broke down in tears when he was confronted by his supervisors. He was afraid that he would be fired for losing his hat because he'd been reprimanded in the past for failing to wear his hat during a traffic stop. And the court said, look, all of these are mitigating circumstances that need to be taken into account. I don't view that holding as being very revolutionary. I think the important part of this court's opinion is the Brady issue, because what the patrol says is, we've got to fire this guy, and we have got to fire him because, in this point forward, in every criminal case in which he's associated, a judicial finding of untruthfulness, which is part of this appeal, the court found, North Carolina Court of Appeals found that Wetherington was untruthful, we're going to have to disclose that under Brady. And thus, Wetherington is of no use as a law enforcement officer. Here's what the North Carolina Court of Appeals says about that argument. It says, Wetherington is not barred from testifying in court. The patrol's argument depends upon at least two assumptions. One, that defense counsel will elect to impeach Wetherington using the finding. And two, that defense counsel's impeachment will necessarily influence a jury to the point that the jury will disregard Wetherington's testimony. Parenthetically, it just screams through the court's opinion. Really? Over a hat? You really think defense counsel is going to try to impeach a trooper over how he lost or misplaced his hat? And you really think a jury is going to be influenced by that? Court doesn't say that out loud, but it, to me, kind of screams through the court's opinion. Back to what the court does say, though. The possibility of impeachment and the possibility of the impeachment's success must both occur in order to diminish Wetherington's performance of the duty to testify unsuccessfully. The patrol presents no argument that the likelihood of the two possibilities justifies Wetherington's termination. The court also goes on to say that the patrol concedes that a trooper is not always the sole witness to a violation of the law, and the court says the patrol points to no other essential job duties that a finding of untruthfulness would diminish or impair. Thus, with the exception of the possibilities which may diminish Wetherington's performance of the duty to testify successfully, Wetherington can fulfill the duties of his office in all other respects, despite the existence of the finding of untruthfulness. And as a result, the court says, the discharge of Wetherington didn't fit his offense and was not necessary to uphold the integrity of the truthfulness policy. In short, the punishment didn't fit the crime. We're seeing this pushback against Brady dismissals, aren't we? I've talked about these in several of the podcasts that we have done. We're seeing arbitrators rejecting automatic terminations for a finding of untruthfulness. We're seeing courts upholding arbitrators' decisions, reinstating officers who've been untruthful. And now we see a court that is the first line of appeal in a disciplinary case. Say, you know what? Untruthfulness and placement on a Brady list in and of itself is not necessarily a basis for discharge. It depends. Depends on the facts and circumstances. And if we have a monthly Brady case, we probably should have a monthly Garcetti case. For those of you who don't know what Garcetti is, this is the Supreme Court's decision 7 years ago, a case called Garcetti versus Sabalos, that if a public employee makes speech as part of their job, they write a report, they write a memo, they write a letter, they engage in a press conference, whatever it is, if it's part of the employee's job, that speech is not protected by the First Amendment. And there is no First Amendment protections against the employer disciplining the employee for the speech, even if it's true. Now, of course, there might be other protections. You might have a collective bargaining agreement that would prohibit a discipline for truthful speech under a just cause provision. You might have civil service laws that apply. What Garcetti did was to take away the possibility of a First Amendment free speech lawsuit. And there's been a lot of litigation over one aspect of Garcetti. Well, there's been a lot of litigation over all aspects of Garcetti. There are probably easily over 100 public safety cases where police officers primarily, but also firefighters, deputies, corrections officers, and troopers have either been disciplined or terminated for speech. And the central issue in the case is Garcetti. Does the Garcetti rule apply so that the employee doesn't have free speech rights? Part of this litigation is over what the employee's job is. Is it the employee's job to make the particular speech? Because if it's not, if the employee is engaged in a comment that is outside of the employee's normal job duties, then the First Amendment does potentially provide protection to the speech. So one of the first lines of inquiries in free speech cases involving public safety employees today is this speech part of the job? And that's what this case that was decided in December involving Jeffrey Taylor, a corporal in the Pennsylvania State Police, that's what this case dealt with. What did Taylor do? In a staff meeting, he voiced objections to what he believed to be an illegal quota system for traffic stops. He didn't just say it in the staff meeting. He sent a letter to the Commissioner of State Police. He also distributed the letter to an internal affairs investigator, and it also was posted on a bulletin board in the local lodge of the Fraternal Order of Police. Taylor later sues the state, saying that he was retaliated against for voicing his concerns about the quota system. And he alleged a variety of forms of kind of lower level retaliation. He didn't get as many overtime opportunities, he got bad evaluations, things like that. No time off, no termination. But certainly enough that you'd have an adverse employment action were this an actionable case. This case ends up in a federal court of appeals, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which dismisses the lawsuit. And what it says is Taylor's protests of the quota system were part of his job. Why? The court says state police policy requires an officer to report through their chain of command any violation by other officers of the law or of department personality. When Taylor is saying we have an illegal quota system, he is saying he is reporting unlawful conduct. That's part of his job. The court says Taylor acted as a public employee and not as a citizen for First Amendment purposes, and because under Garcetti he was speaking as an employee, his speech wasn't protected by the First Amendment and he can't sue for retaliation. But wait a minute, you may say. Didn't Taylor send the letter to the Fraternal Order of Police and wasn't it posted on a bulletin board? That's not part of his job, surely. You know, for a law enforcement officer to send something to their labor organization. Doesn't that take this case outside of Garcetti? The court says no. The FOP posting, I'm quoting here, cannot rescue Taylor's claim. Taylor has failed to point to any evidence demonstrating that the FOP posting was a substantial factor in the patrol's allegedly retaliatory conduct. He needed to point to some evidence that the patrol was reacting to the FOP posting as opposed to reacting to his letter to the superintendent, or commissioner of state police, his letter to the IA investigator, or his comments that were made at the staff meeting. As a result, Taylor loses his First Amendment lawsuit. By now, this is a pretty predictable result under Garcetti. The last case I want to talk about this month is a bit of an anomaly. It's an ADA case involving a police officer. You don't see many ADA cases involving police officers. You used to, but then we had a series of rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court that cut back on ADA rights that public employees have. Most of those Supreme Court rulings were overturned by Congress in 2008 when it enacted what's known as the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act, the ADAAA, if you like statutory acronyms. And we're just now starting to see police officer, firefighter, public safety employee, ADA litigation come back to life after this long period of quiescence where there just basically wasn't the ability to file a discrimination lawsuit. And what we've got this month is an interesting case out of Chattanooga, Tennessee, the police department in Chattanooga, involving a police officer by the name of Mikkel Hoback. And it involves a question of whether or not if you apply for disability through some other disability system, are you admitting that you can't do the essential functions of the job for purposes of being protected by the ADA? In other words, if you say in one form that you are disabled, aren't you by definition walking away from your ADA claim? Because in order to prevail under the ADA, you have to show that with reasonable accommodation, you can do the essential functions of the job. So what went on with Hoback? Hoback, shortly after starting work as a police officer for the city of Chattanooga, serves in Iraq for a year in the military. When he returns, he's diagnosed with PTSD. He ends up being placed on some psychotropic medication through treatment that he received with the VA. He continued to have difficulties. In 2009, he went to his usual therapist, a fellow named Bearden, and complained about headaches, vomiting, intrusive thoughts, and sleeplessness. Eventually, the city of Chattanooga hears about that, puts him through a fitness for duty process, and a doctor who apparently does not consult with any of the other doctors who treated or evaluated Hoback, a doctor concluded that Hoback was not fit for duty. The city reacted to that eventually by terminating Hoback. Now, Hoback, on his side, did have doctors who said that he was fit for duty, and they said that he was fit for duty even, in one case, with some accommodations, in another case, even without accommodations. Hoback brings an Americans with Disabilities Act lawsuit saying, look, I can do the essential functions of the job, whether or not I have reasonable accommodations from the city. That case goes to a jury, and the jury awards Hoback $680,000, fines in his favor, awards him back pay, awards him emotional distress damages of $250,000, and awards him something called front pay, meaning he's probably not getting his job back, but this is money that will compensate him for loss of salary in the future until he can get himself reemployed. The city challenges the jury's award before the Federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the city's argument's a simple one. The jury's award is categorically inconsistent with the fact that Hoback went to the VA and applied for and received disability benefits. And the court says, no, it's not necessarily inconsistent. Those two things are not necessarily inconsistent. And turning to the court's opinion, the court says, we find no reason to set aside the jury's verdict. The record doesn't show that Hoback ever said that he was unable to work, and the city doesn't point to any obvious inconsistencies between Hoback's application for benefits and the position taken in the litigation that he was covered by the ADA. The law does not require employees to choose between applying for benefits and pursuing an ADA claim. They may do both. So, in other words, the simple fact that someone says in one form, look, I'm disabled, doesn't mean for ADA purposes in another form that they can't do the essential functions of the job. That's it for this month. I didn't get through everything. There's just too much to cover. But be sure to check in with our newsletter, our print newsletter, Public Safety Labor Relations, where I'll summarize a number of other cases. And I hope the new year is greeting you well. We hope to see you in February, both for our podcast. We also have a seminar in February. This is our only union-only seminar. Normally, our seminars, we invite both employers and unions to. The February seminar, though, is on kind of the nuts and bolts of how to run a labor organization. It's going to be in Las Vegas. Hope to see you either there, or if not, see you at the next podcast.